Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour decided to put together an absolutely fascinating compilation of facts about U.S. presidents. When he was putting together the book, he had to decide what to include, and he says if it was odd to me, and I felt that 9 out of 10 people would say something along the lines of, "Are you kidding?" then it tended to be included. If a presidential fact was especially interesting, intriguing, or relevant to today's world, but not necessarily odd, the goal was to have fun with history and to teach readers about little-known aspects of the lives of American presidents. And indeed, he has done just that. The book is titled Grover Cleveland's Rubber Jaw and Other Unusual, Unexpected, Unbelievable, but All True Facts About America's Presidents. Stephen Spignesi is our guest. He's the author of a number of books, including George Washington's Leadership Lessons, American Firsts, a U.S. Book of Lists, What's Your Red, White, and Blue IQ, The Italian 100, and many other books. And we're happy to have him with us this hour of the program. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now they charge a lot of money to have your dog's teeth cleaned. George Washington brushed his horse's teeth every day.
Yeah, he did. He was very meticulous about that, and yet, as was common for that era, unfortunately, his own dental care was less than
right.
hoped for. When he, when he was inaugurated, he had one tooth in his mouth. The rest had fallen out from either gum disease or decay, and this was prior to his having, you know, bridges made that he could wear. But his horses, they got very excellent dental care.
I thought that was funny. I found your book just so interesting. I read almost all of it. I have some of the modern day presidents yet to read, but I figure I know a little bit more about them. So I wanted to concentrate on a lot of those people in the middle who I get them all mixed up, you know, what their order was of the presidency. And there were some other stories about bad teeth, weren't there? Or no teeth? Well, who was the other president you wrote about who didn't have teeth, I think?
Washington was one, and there were several other presidents who had bridges made. top of my head, I can't think of the one you're referring to, but the idea back then was that dental care was essentially not irrelevant. People did rinse with water and eat apples to try and keep their teeth clean. That was common folklore. But overall, tooth loss was just, Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, talking about our ancestors, said that, you know, the life expectancy was very, very low, primarily because of the teeth. Hmm. Gum disease can cause heart disease, and so, you know, mm-hmm. there wasn't, dental care is a fairly modern kind of invention. So the president suffered. They did. I'm working on a book about ailments of the famous and the infamous, and many historical figures suffered from tooth pain and jaw infections and gum infections, and you know, actually Grover Cleveland, the title of the book that you just mentioned, my book, he had jaw cancer, and that's where the title of the book comes from. He developed cancer in his left upper jaw, and five surgeons and a dentist removed his upper jaw and replaced it with one of rubber. And it was 24 years before the American public knew about it, because back then, no media, so there was no public speaking, and the people who he kind of just put off doing speeches until he could develop the kind of verbal articulation required. And it was a common ailment at the time, yeah. Huh.
And was this the surgery that was done on the yacht?
The Oneida, absolutely. What
right.
they did, you know, this was 1893, and they were going through a depression. And the fear was that if a president of the United States was diagnosed with cancer and it was made public, not only would America freak out, but the rest of the world would too, because, You know, and that kind of brings me to the idea of the presidency as an institution. The impact that a president being sick can have is just mind-boggling all over the world. And, you know, the presidency has always fascinated me. And frankly, I've always been a little bit suspicious about the office. Mainly because, yeah, the Constitution, you know, we have our three branches of government, okay? And the executive branch, the president, it's supposed to be co-equal. There's supposed to be checks and balances. There's supposed to be the ability to essentially eliminate the possibility of a monarchy, which is what we fled. And yet, we want the president. It's kind of like an American schizophrenia, a political science schizophrenia, I think. We want the president to make the big decisions on his own. Mm-hmm. That's why we elect these men. We believe they can be leaders. We believe that they can make the right decisions at the right time, regardless of what the judicial branch or the legislative branch says. We want the president. And you know what's been a very odd development? Signing statements. It's very interesting to me. When signing statements began to be used, President Bush used a lot of them, President Obama's using them, other presidents have used them. Basically, it's a letter that says, I'm not going to comply with that law, by the way. Mm-hmm. If the Congress passes a law, the president can issue what's called a signing statement, which basically says, I'm going to do what I want. And what's most interesting to me is that it's accepted that he has the authority to do this. Now, of course, there are always people who challenge these in the media, in politics. They say, oh, he shouldn't be allowed to do that. But it's constitutional. It is not extra legal. And so there's this weird kind of, we want him to make the right decisions, but we also want the checks and balances in place. And I think basically what we've done over the years is kind of settle into this happy and sometimes unhappy compromise that the president is going to do what he's going to do, but we do have systems in place just in case. Mm-hmm. And you know, the notion of the presidency, the imperial presidency, the president in America is an odd kind of institution. England has had 66 monarchs in 1,500 years. We've had 44 presidents in 236 years. We get a new one every 5 years. It's on average. And so we kind of get impatient. We have a constitutional limit of two terms, which some say, I heard Richard Belzer on the Bill Maher show the other night, he's been pushing for a 1 6-year term, believing that, you know, like in France, he said that would eliminate the need to concentrate efforts in the last 2 years of a president's administration on re-election. It's an interesting thought. Yeah. It truly is, you know.
It's interesting, going back to George Washington, that we didn't exactly know what to call the first president, and I found this interesting. The title originally suggested by a Senate committee, you write, was His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of the Rights of Same. Can you imagine having that today?
Right, His Highness, right. And, you know, God bless George Washington. He was just phenomenal. And he said, no way.
Right.
I am not Your Highness. No, thank you. And he's the one who went for the basic Mr. President, the President of the United States, which is absolutely magnificent in its simplicity. Yep. The President of the United States. And if you replaced the with these, which presidents often do in discourse and rhetoric, it speaks to the whole notion of America. These United States, we are united. Sometimes we're one country, sometimes we're individual states. And that's just such a beautiful concept in terms of governing. And, you know, de Tocqueville said, you know, democracy is a bad system, except that it's the best of everything else. You know, it's something along those lines, where even though there are flaws in the democratic process of democracy, it's still better than anything else any country has ever tried throughout world history.
Mm-hmm. So was it highly likely that George Washington was sterile?
Yeah, pretty much. He never impregnated his wife. Martha was never pregnant throughout the entire presidency. There is a rumor that he impregnated one of his brother's slaves. But there's been great controversy over that. And in fact, one of the descendants of that slave has written a book in which he claims genealogical connection to George Washington. But it's not really been proved. I don't know if there's been DNA testing, et cetera. It's one of those things. So basically, we look to the historical record, and it's quite possible that he was. And you know, remember, he had smallpox, dysentery, pleurisy, and malaria when he was young. Of those, smallpox could easily make one sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it very young when he traveled with his brother. So, you know, it's possible. And what's interesting about the smallpox thing, I think having it must have kind of really impacted him psychologically, because he came up with, he didn't come up with it. One of his slaves did. The first smallpox inoculation in America. One of his slaves was from Africa. And he told Washington that when members of his tribe came down with smallpox, they would take a very pointed stick and they would poke one of the eruptions on the skin. And then they would stab or, you know, poke other members of the tribe, basically inoculating them against smallpox. Washington did it to everyone on his on Mount Vernon and his family, and no one got smallpox.
Yeah, amazing. It was really striking to me to read about, because a lot of these early presidents would get sick and were afflicted by those aforementioned diseases, and what they did to try to get rid of it. All the bleeding that took place and the self-bleeding that some of these presidents would do, you're really struck by how far medicine has advanced since those years.
Oh, back then, no medical schools. You know, doctors basically studied like apprentice-like with other physicians, and old home remedies and folk remedies were the rule. I mean, they bled, as you said, they bled people. They thought that that would work. they made them ingest the most horrible things, charcoal and ash. They made them drink charcoal and ash. They would tried a very primitive form of removing, they believed that infections were in the body that they needed to come out. So they thought nothing of, as you said, the bleeding and actually, you know, tapping the stomach, putting a tube to try and get out the bile and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no sanitation whatsoever. I mean, they worked with bare hands, dirty hands. In fact, President Garfield probably died from toxic septicemia because the doctors worked inside his body looking for the bullet barehanded. And you're absolutely right. The changes have been exponential. I mean, once we learned germ theory and went from there, it's really not small leaps, massive leaps in understanding of how the body works, what's needed to be done, and then the invention of antibiotics, which was an American first. You mentioned my earlier book. That did it. That just doubled life expectancies because we were able to understand germs, how to treat them, how to get rid of them, and sanitation, how critical it was. That, you know, infections. I mean, yeah, people died from viruses and they died from, you know, innate diseases like cancer and so forth, but infection was huge, and they just didn't have the understanding or the technology to treat it.
And who was the president, I'm trying to remember, I have all these little facts in my head after reading your book, who died of gastrointestinitis because it was a really hot day in Washington and he was terribly overdressed. It was in July, the dog days of summer, and he thought to get cool, what he should do was eat a huge bowl of cherries and drink a lot of cold milk. And you had to be careful of that because there wasn't a lot of, those were foods that you probably shouldn't eat because it wasn't sanitary in those days to eat those. And he died because he had cold milk and a big bowl of cherries.
Zachary Taylor.
It was Zachary
Taylor, yeah. You know, and honestly, I've often wondered about that. Why would, well, then again, the thinking back then was, you know, nowhere near what it is today. But the notion that I'm sweating, I'm ridiculously hot, I'm dressed in layers,
yeah.
I'm just in agony with the heat, so I'm going to eat.
Right.
You know, where's the connect between the process of sweating and being hot and eating? And so, yes, cold cherries and milk, and also no pasteurization, so who knows,
right,
what the milk was like. And that basically kind of just shut down his system. Although, for years, because of the ludicrous nature of how his death was basically attributed, what was attributed to be causing his death, people always thought that Zach Taylor was poisoned. Many people did. In fact, in the 80s, there was a professor, well, she's still around, Clara Rising. She believed Zachary Taylor was poisoned, murdered. And she actually persuaded Zachary Taylor's descendant, closest relative, to approve an exhumation and post-mortem testing. No. He wasn't poisoned. There wasn't a hint of poison in any of his remains. And so we go back to the fact that this massive bout of viral gastroenteritis, or viral, I don't know, probably bacterial, now that we're talking about it, I don't think he caught a virus on the podium. I think it was probably bacterial from the dirty fruit and the unpasteurized milk, and it just basically shut him down. Gastroenteritis can be fatal.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what did him in. Yeah, Zachary Taylor.
Stephen Spignesi is our guest. His book is Grover Cleveland's Rubber Jaw and Other Unusual, Unexpected, Unbelievable, but All True Facts About America's Presidents. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org, and visit our Facebook page if you'd like, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, a man who many people thought should be president, and maybe it's not too late, except I think he's ruled it out, Colin Powell will be joining us at 9 o'clock. He has a new book, It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership, so that's part of tomorrow's program. Also, the Second Lady of the United States, Joe Biden, will be with us for part of we have a pretty good lineup for tomorrow, huh? Will be with us for part of tomorrow's show. Betsy in River Falls is our first caller this hour. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I wanted to find out how we got how the executive order came into existence. And people told me it was from the Constitution, and it isn't because I've read it. So I went to the Federal Library at the University of River Falls. And in the Federal Register, George Washington wrote to his first Congress saying, how do we do this? How does this government work? How do we accomplish what we're trying to accomplish? And that was executive order number one. So that's how we got the precedent for this powerful, powerful thing, the executive order, and I just think that's fascinating.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I heard earlier this year, I think it was, that there's a president of the United States from 1850, John Tyler of Tippecanoe and Tyler II fame, 10 years before the Civil War, who actually has two grandsons that are alive in the U.S. today, and I was wondering if that's actually true and how it came to be.
I think, well, first of all, John, do you mean John Tyler? Because he was 1841 to 1845.
I thought it was 1850 what I heard, but maybe I'm mistaken. I'm almost sure it was John Tyler that I had heard that.
Well, as far as I know, there are some descendants. He was prolific.
He had 15 kids.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are, you know, it's not that long ago, you know, 150 years. So I would bet that you're right, sir, that there are some descendants. I can't state with certainty because I haven't looked it up and dug into it yet, but it would not surprise me if you're absolutely correct, yeah.
It amazes me that they'd be grandsons, though.
Well, he...
Great-grandsons, right?
Well, no. What I had heard were grandsons. I had heard that he had fathered a child in his 70s, late 70s, and that his son had had children in his late 70s.
Grandsons, wow.
So these would be grandsons from what I had heard, and they're alive today.
That's fascinating. I hope you're right.
Yeah. Well,
I really do. I hope you're absolutely because, having someone still alive from connected genealogically to that era is just fascinating to me. I'm going to check into that. I absolutely will look into it and get a confirmed answer for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. We're all dashing off to our computers later on to find out if that's true. Well, he got married. This is possible, I guess, because didn't he get married for the second time, you write, when he was in his 50s, and he married his second wife was 30 years younger than he.
Right. He does have living grandchildren. I'm
he
confirming
does.
Confirming it. Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
And also, James Garfield. There are living grandchildren of James Garfield as well. So, yes, excellent call. Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you, John.
It.
Oh, our listeners are on top of things. And somebody has written in.
NPR listeners?
You
absolutely.
Got it. The best. The best. Rachel on Facebook writes, and you write about this too, and I'm struck by this, James Garfield able to translate and write in Greek with his left hand and write the same text in Latin with his right hand. Isn't that amazing? He was an interesting guy.
He was, and that's, this goes back to my earlier comment about the oddness of the presidency and the people who aspire to it, and yet the majority of presidents ultimately make comments that they were so glad to get out of the presidency. And I've been thinking about the job, the presidency. It's $400,000 a year now. That's the salary.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it strike you as a bit suspicious that people would spend tens of millions of dollars of their own money to get elected to a job that pays $400,000? Now, the majority of them say, oh, I want to serve the country. It's for the good of the country, the greater good, and I believe I can do a great job. And I accept that. I mean, most presidents, all presidents, I have to give them the benefit of the doubt, go into the office wanting to make things better for America, Americans, and the world. I believe that. I'm a big West Wing fan, which always spoke to the nobility of the presidency and the higher aspirations of serving the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. But still, I think in this era, with money basically deciding who gets elected, because if you put a million ads on TV, you're going to get all those eyes, you're going to get people considering voting for you. If you don't have the money to do that, people walk into the voting booth, they've never heard of you or they don't know you. And that extends all the way down from the presidency to congressmen and aldermen. So I think there's been an evolution of the presidency that not all of it's good. Not all of it's good. A $400,000 a year job that costs, $20, $30, $40 million to win, it just strikes me as a problem. I really do. I think it can bring out the worst in people. I think it's something that we should probably try and remedy in a way. I mentioned Bill Maher earlier. He said we should make voting mandatory, that it should be a requirement, like having car insurance, and we should do it on the weekend. We should make voting easier so that the politicians don't feel this desperate urge to just flood media because there's going to be a constant national awareness of what's going on that would hopefully generate the kind of turnout that, gets us the president we want.
Yeah. Let's go to Kyle next, where our John Tyler tale deepens. Kyle in Michigan. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that back in 2007, Vision Forum from San Antonio, Texas, had a 400-year anniversary celebration of Jamestown.
Uh-huh.
We actually were on Harrison Tyler, John Tyler's grandson's land. It's called Fort Pocahontas, and our family got our picture taken with him.
No.
It's his grandson, and he's probably in his 70s, I think, by now.
Right, yeah. Kathleen, you were talking about Tyler marrying. Yeah, he was 54, and his wife, second wife, was 23. So, yeah, and he had the 15 children with two wives, and John Tyler was an interesting guy. He had one term, and he had some less than admirable traits. He supported slavery, but then again, this redeems him in my mind. He became physically ill upon witnessing an auction. But he was also kind of uncomfortable around the teeming masses. He was a bit of an elitist, but he was a really interesting guy, and it's fascinating that his heirs survived.
It sure is. And a lot of the presidents, you list the numbers who had slaves. I found this was interesting. I never knew this. Warren Harding, in 1922, the Ku Klux Klan inducted Harding into the Klan at a White House ceremony. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, he was actually inducted 1922, and he accepted the, what can we call it, accolade? I hate to use that word, but you know what I mean. He considered the members to be valid constituents and basically accepted membership in their organization. And, you know, Harding had some problems. He had some issues, and his wife was cheaper than the day is long. Florence was unbelievable. She made the White House cooks get 60 cups of coffee out of a pound.
Hmm.
Normal is 32. So he didn't care. He lost this one. I love, you know, the White House China. Every administration, well, most administrations will have new China designed with their particular pattern. Usually the First Lady picks it out. He lost a set of presidential China in a poker game.
Hmm.
Warren Harding.
And he fathered an illegitimate child, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he also spent time in a psychiatric institution in his 20s. He had a series of what they used to call nervous breakdowns, which are now just called dissociative personality breaks, or whatever the technical term is now for it. War, and you know, this goes back to the theme of the book, that the presidency is such a unique position, and its pressure is so unimaginable that the best and the worst, I remember a president saying that the presidency will bring out the best and the worst in a person without fail. Their absolute noblest aspirations will be revealed, and their worst, most petty traits will also be revealed, because the pressure and the microscope that they're under is, and the decisions they have to make are so...
I can't imagine, yes.
I can't either.
Yeah.
I mean, and so the presidents that handle it with aplomb and grace, it's just so admirable.
Yeah.
That they can be cool and centered and not freak out
right.
at the pressures, yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, interesting, fascinating guy, terrified of public speaking. You write, during his two terms, he only gave two public speeches, and those were the inaugural addresses. Isn't that something?
Yeah, he was, you know, Jefferson was a nervous guy. He really was. He had, and he was very progressive. I mean, he was basically a vegetarian. He was an inventor. He invented the swivel chair and the dumb waiter. He had stress-related headaches constantly. This is another thing. You're president, and you're under this constant pressure, and you don't feel well.
Right.
One can only imagine how horrible that must be. He said that when he was Secretary of State, he wrote that he had a headache all day, every day, for 6 weeks. And that was when he was serving as Secretary of the State. And he also refused to allow his terms as president to be on his tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. He was a really fascinating guy, and brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Just one, I read somewhere his IQ is in the 160s, and it doesn't surprise me considering, you know, he designed Monticello, mm-hmm. and he was an inventor, and he read constantly. He was a writer. I'm fascinated by Jefferson.
Yeah, he is fascinating. And he took cold foot baths, thinking that they would give him longevity.
Huh. Yeah, and you know, he had a nice long life, so
maybe there's something to it.
Maybe there's something to it. I mean, you know, he was, how old was he, 43, so he was 57 and 26 is 77, 83. You know, in that day and age, considering the medical care situation, so who knows, you know. Although, frankly, I think the fact that he eschewed meat for the most part, I think that had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. I found it fascinating to read what some of the presidents like to have for breakfast. Was it John Adams who drank beer for breakfast? Ew.
Beer and bread. Beer and bread. Yeah. These are the Harry Truman had a shot of whiskey every
day. Oh, my
day.
Gosh.
I believe it was Harding or Woodrow Wilson, I'm not sure which one, insisted that his morning egg be boiled for 30 minutes. I know. Calvin Coolidge boiled oats and rye. And bringing it up to modern era, you know, Gerald Ford, his lunch was, well, I don't want to trash people who would enjoy this kind of thing, but he had cottage cheese with A1 steak sauce.
Oh, sure.
And ice cream. That was it. Check this out. Cottage cheese with A1 steak sauce, a slice of onion, and ice cream.
That was lunch.
Obviously, he wasn't lactose intolerant.
I guess not. Actually, it doesn't sound all that bad. I'd skip the onion. But
the steak sauce and the onion probably really appealed to him. But he had that every day.
Oh, my.
You know, and in fact, LBJ, he had a special button in his. As a matter of fact, his desk chair was a helicopter chair, which he had specifically retrofitted to be his presidential chair. And he had a special button on it, and every time he pressed it, the galley would have to immediately bring upstairs a Fresca. He loved Fresca.
Can you even buy Fresca now?
Yeah.
You can,
still,
huh?
Yeah, grapefruit soda, yeah. Oh. And in fact, there's a, you know, I mentioned the West Wing earlier. There's an interesting moment in one of the episodes where they hire a Republican lawyer because they're looking for
right.
bipartisanship. And she goes down to the galley and said, I'd like a muffin and a Fresca. Oh, we don't have Fresca. And she says, you really should carry Fresca. And that's got to be Aaron Sorkin nodding to LBJ.
Interesting. There's an interesting, and I think this is in your book or I read it somewhere else, the cheese in the lobby of the White House that Leo is talking about, and then they all have to have people come in who want to plead their case, people who may not get into the White House normally. Was there a big thing at cheese that Andrew Jackson said everybody can come and have?
Yes.
There
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. It was 2 tons. And it was donated to him, and he aged it in the White House, and then he opened the doors. In fact, in my book, I do the math and tell you how many people and how much cheese per person they ate on that day when he allowed the public to come in and just have some cheese. You're right. The West Wing did a whole episode based on that, but Aaron Sorkin kind of little bent the history a little bit, and he said that Jackson did it annually. He didn't. Mm. He did it once. mm-hmm. when he had this massive two-ton piece of cheese that basically at that point he probably was thinking, I got to get rid of this thing. Taking up, imagine two-ton hunk of cheese, you know.
No, yeah. I can't exactly. We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Grover Cleveland's Rubber Jaw and Other Unusual, Unexpected, Unbelievable, but All True Facts About America's Presidents. The author, Stephen Spignesi, is our guest this hour. And we're welcoming your phone calls. He covers all of them, and they're just really fascinating stories. It makes for terrific conversation. Did you know that? Did I give you the email? It's talk@WPR.org, and you can go to the Facebook page if you'd like to add a phenomenally interesting fact. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, Colin Powell will be joining us. He has a new book, which is on the New York Times bestseller list, I noticed yesterday. It worked for me in life and leadership. Also, Dr. Joe Biden will be joining us to talk about military families. So those are a couple of our shows for tomorrow. Back to phone calls with Stephen, and let's go to Dorothy in Maquanico. Hi, Dorothy.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am reading a book by Helen Bryan, which is the autobiography of Martha Washington. And in it, she writes about a man named Thomas Posey, who was rumored to be the son of George Washington.
Hmm.
I wondered if your author knows anything about that.
You know, that might be the fellow I mentioned earlier, that, you know, Washington impregnated one of his brother's slaves and had a son and treated him well. But he was the illegitimate son. Although this might be something different, because Posey was a friend of Washington, so it's hard to really know who's who. But it does kind of put some lie to the rumor or the suggestion that Washington was sterile. We've got the Posey rumor, and we've got the son of the slave rumor. I think they're separate. My best guess is that it's true. It wouldn't surprise me. This went on a lot back then. You read the Revolutionary War, the early years of American histories, and you'll find that this was not uncommon. So, you know, now, of course, we're burdened with the responsibility of proving these things. Although the George Washington Leadership Lessons book I wrote with the executive director of Mount Vernon, James Reese, the son of the alleged son of the slave that Washington supposedly fathered was welcomed at Mount Vernon.
Hmm.
Yes, and there was this somewhat tacit acknowledgement that his story was true and that his genealogy led back to President Washington. So, you know, the thing is, I think that as more and more records become revealed and studied, we'll ultimately get final genealogies. But yeah, the Posey and the other one are two of the alleged sons of Washington.
I was saddened to read the number of presidents, and I believe Washington was one of them, where Martha burned most of his papers. Alas, alas, how can you burn the papers of the first president of the United States? But other wives did that as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And it was always at the request of the president, the dying president. I'm of mixed feelings about that. I understand the privacy or desire. I understand that presidents don't want to be second-guessed after their death. I understand that some of the correspondences and diary entries might have been far more personal. But then again, as you just indicated, the president of the United States, you know, it is such a huge, iconic position in human history, in American history, that perhaps we should eschew destruction of anything relative to their past and their history, and instead embrace it as a more revealing look at the truth involved. Because, you know, the more you dig into the president's history, the more you learn about their personalities. We know now, for instance, that Teddy Roosevelt, did you know he was a proponent of assisted suicide?
Mm.
He carried a bottle of morphine with him wherever he went.
Yes.
Because he believed in self-euthanasia and said if he contracted something, you know, away from home and became incapacitated, he would end his own life rather than linger on in pain. These are things that you know, Polk, he carried his money around in a suitcase, and Jackson believed the world was flat. So, you know, you start finding these things out. And, of course, all this information came from writings by them and about them. So is the ultimate goal, I'm an educator. You know, I teach at the University of New Haven, and I believe education is the silver bullet and that the more we know, the better. And if there is any role in American history that should be completely delineated, it's probably the presidency. So, you know, burning those records, and let's face it, it was due to embarrassment. You know, they were embarrassed or they just didn't want to be post-mortem analyzed.
Right.
Right or wrong, they own them. You know, we had the same thing with Salinger. You know, letters that J.D. Salinger wrote to friends that ultimately ended up in biographies, he sued to prevent them because he didn't want that kind of personal communication revealed to the public. He owned them. So technically, he was completely within his realm to do so. But then again, J.D. Salinger, he's this enormously iconic American writer. Do we have the right, as the public, to know as everything there is to know about him? Or is he and, therefore, presidents, entitled to some semblance
right.
of privacy after their death?
Speaking of analyzing, I found it. I didn't know this was true. I'd like to read this at some point. Sigmund Freud writing a book in which he psychoanalyzed Woodrow Wilson. It was published after he died, claiming Wilson was severely dysfunctional, needed to be worshipped, and had been emotionally smothered by his mother.
Right. Now, well, first of all, you know, Harry Truman was completely against psychiatry and nut doctors. He didn't believe in psychiatry. But for those who do support the study of the psychology of the human brain, Freud's opinion probably would carry some significant weight. So let's assume that there was some credence to that. What does that say in terms of analyzing Wilson's presidency, analyzing his decisions, analyzing his relationships? This is what I mean when I say that, you know, if we limit the writings available about presidents, then perhaps we're not getting as complete a picture of history as we could.
We must spend some time. Oh, let's take a phone call, and then we'll go to our very, very, very heavy president, Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes, could you give some information about George Washington's parents, how they made a living, and also a surveying party? What did Washington survey, Virginia, and anything else? And did they have servants, or was he quite adept as a woodsman? Thank you.
Okay. Well, he had slaves. We know that. They were treated extremely well, as the caller indicates, servants. They were, his father was a planter, and he owned tobacco plantations and slaves, which he bought and sold. And his mother was a housewife, you know, of course, ran the house. And the other surveying thing, yes, Washington was a surveyor, and his records of surveying Mount Vernon still exist in his own hand. In fact, Library of Congress has published them, and they are available. And, you know, this is another example of just the intelligence of the Washington Adams, Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, James Monroe era. These men were mainly, they were educated. They did go to higher institutions, but they were eclectic. After Washington was president, did you know he was the biggest distiller in the country,
mm-hmm.
making thousands of barrels of whiskey? So they were businessmen who had to survive doing whatever they could. And, of course, knowing the boundaries of your land was critical. So, yeah, he was an established surveyor, yeah.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about the man who loved almonds so much. In fact, he really loved almonds. He'd eat pounds of almonds at a single sitting, and he carried quite a few pounds himself.
Taft.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was
a big man.
He was huge. He was like 340.
Wow.
And he got stuck in the White House bathtub shortly after he was inaugurated. And so they had to get him out, and they immediately had a massive tub, more like a mini sauna, I guess, installed to carry his girth. And, you know, this, again, speaks to the evolution of the president. Could a 340-pound man today get elected?
Probably not.
Well, Chris Christie's overweight, but he's not obese.
Yeah, he's not 340.
He's overweight. You know, he's not 340. But there is talk about his weight. And, you know, someone was telling me recently that after Eisenhower got elected, I think it was a journalist. I'm not sure who told where I read it or who told it to me, but they said, you know, Eisenhower, we may be witnessing the last bald president.
Huh.
And, you know, that just spoke volumes to me about the perceptions that we have as the American public. Could a bald man get elected president today? Could an obese 350-pound man get elected president today? How much of it is facade? How much of it is appearance? Everybody talks about Romney's presidential hair.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody talks about Obama's persona as cool and playing basketball, and he's a sharp dresser when he's not in a suit. You know, these perceptions, first of all, we know they factor in to people's voting habits. My question is, and I'm not saying right or wrong, is should they? Should the fact that Eisenhower was bald, if he was running today, even if you loved his policies, would his baldness detract? Are we that shallow a nation that we would not elect someone worthy of being president because he was bald? That journalist who told me that thought so. He said in a TV era, these people have to look good. They have to look ordinary. They have to look mainstream. They can't be at the least bit eccentric or odd or unusual or have these things like massive body weight or baldness. There are no more bearded presidents. There are no more mustached presidents. And yet back in the day that you were talking about, the mutton chops.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Right?
A whole different style.
And Grover Cleveland, he had that massive walrus mustache, which basically helped him with his rubber jaw.
Yeah. But getting back to Taft for a moment, you also write about the fact that he fell asleep all the time and that his wife had to wake him up if he was working at his desk by putting on a Caruso record. But perhaps it was because of all of that weight that he fell asleep all the time. So it becomes a health consideration. You can't fall asleep doing the work of the country at your desk because you're overweight. It's not a good thing, right?
And that also speaks to how much should we know about our presidents. Do their medical records and do their health profile, should that be an issue? You know that when Ronald Reagan had a non-malignant growth on his nose,
mm-hmm.
he had to check into Bethesda as a woman. In fact, it's in my book in the chapter on Reagan, because it wasn't until years later that they revealed that it was a minor removal of a benign growth. But originally, when he had the surgery, because of the ceaseless media attention, he couldn't check in as the president. And, of course, they had to spin the results so that ultimately it was blown off as something trivial and irrelevant. Taft sleeping at his desk because of his weight or because he suffered from narcolepsy, we don't know. So, you know, it all goes back to my earlier point about does this impact our understanding of how they made decisions? We know JFK was on all kinds of medication when he was
president. He sure was.
And he had Addison's disease. He was on amphetamines. He was on steroids. How did that affect his decision-making process during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example? We know that one of the side effects of some of these medications was an increase in testosterone. Did that? He was a hound.
He was. Right.
And did that impact? Was that cut due to the medications he was on? None of us knew this. The media kept all of this a secret.
Yeah, it's a different world. Stephen, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. It's really a fascinating book.
Thanks,
I enjoyed
Stephanie.
It thoroughly.
Stephen, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Spignesi, the author of Grover Cleveland's Rubber Jaw and Other Unusual, Unexpected, Unbelievable, but All True Facts About America's Presidents. It's a fun, fun read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program for On Air Production. Tomorrow, Colin Powell at 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.